You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
When I met Jack was about 21 years old. He was getting ready to graduate from college. And Jack was terrified. Absolutely terrified. What was interesting about Jack's terror is it wasn't about simply the fact that he was about to graduate from college and needed to have a sense of where he was going to get money, how he was going to pay rent, how he was going to make a living. It really ultimately wasn't about financial fears. It wasn't ultimately about where he was going to live or those kinds of questions. At the end of the day, when I finally kind of got to the bottom of what was going on in Jack's world, Jack was terrified. His name really wasn't Jack. Jack was terrified because he didn't know the answer to the question, what am I supposed to do? He knew he needed money to pay rent. He knew he needed a place to live. He knew he needed to pick a place to live. But foundational, kind of underneath all of those questions, was not just, hey, I guess I'll get a job because I got to pay, I have to pay for things. But at the end of it was like, I've spent 4 years in college and an exorbitant amount of money, and I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm here for. The advice that he'd gotten from his father, the advice he'd gotten from his pastor, the advice he'd gotten from his friends, it was essentially, well, what do you want to do? What do you like to do? What do you enjoy? And those questions kind of spun out into kind of an endless array of options of, like, well, I like to ski, but I'm not going to be a professional skier. I like to draw, but I'm probably not going to make much money drawing. I like to decorate things, but I don't know if I can make much money decorating things. There was a sheer fear and terror that came as he thought about just the absolute abundance of options set in front of him. Here was a young man, about to enter kind of his post-educational life. And he didn't know what he was on this earth for. He didn't know what a human being was for. But we live in a day and age that is just shot through with massive confusion. And confusion may not be the right word. I would say maybe desperation around the concept of identity. Who are we? What are we supposed to do with our lives? We have, if you've paid any attention to certain trends within society, personality tests have become all the rage. I was reading up on the Enneagram this week and kind of just noticing how many therapists now have kind of sprung out of, like if you're a therapist, I apologize, like weeds, all to kind of guide you through how the Enneagram should shape your life. And friends who give DISC tests that kind of help people figure out the question that surrounds those kinds of tests. Tests everywhere, therapy everywhere. And here's the crazy thing that I noticed this week. That surrounding these tests, surrounding these personality things, is shot through with the language of shame, the language of grace, the language of forgiveness, the language of finding yourself. Authors like Brené Brown, making a massive living, trying to help people come to terms with their own identity. Making lots and lots of money talking about identity. Talking about helping people learn to accept themselves. There's a kind of desperation in our culture around identity and around these tests. And please don't get me wrong. I think things like the Enneagram or the TTI test or things like that can be massively useful around issues like self-awareness and how to relate to other people. But it seems like our culture is looking for something else there. Something like, how do I alleviate the pressure that lays upon my life that we call shame or we call guilt? Looking there for something like salvation, because all of us are just lost. Desperate to answer the question, who in the world am I and what am I for? And we're looking for salvation in all the wrong places. We live in a culture that has kind of dismissed God from the equation. If you believe in God, that's fine. But he isn't necessary for determining what humans are. And so we live in a culture that has divorced itself from the one thing that can provide a kind of solid foundation for understanding who we are and what we're for in the midst of the world. And so we take the concept of identity and we begin to do all kinds of strange things with it. We begin to attach all kinds of strange things to it. Identity in our culture has been weaponized so that in political realms or in social conversations, the whole idea of identity has now become a political weapon to drive wedges between whole groups of people that if they would just sit down and have a meal, they'd actually like each other. But we attach identity to our sexuality, what you desire to do sexually. So now that's not simply something that you want to do. It's now some aspect of who you are intrinsically. And to criticize someone's sexual desires is now to kind of undermine their very personhood. But we live in a world that historically, for centuries, has attached skin color. Just the pigment of my skin has attached pigment to identity. So it's not just that some of us have darker skin or lighter skin that happens to be maybe an accident of geography from where we're from in the world historically. But instead, it becomes a very identity marker, whether you're white or you're black. Discrimination and politicization of something like how much melatonin is in my skin. But we live in a world that has for decades upon decades attached identity to the productivity of your life. How successful are you? How much have you accomplished? And so people somehow find an identity, find their own self-worth, kind of measure themselves over against everyone else, defining their humanity and their identity by how much money they made or how successful they are in whatever field they've chosen, or natural talents. A song that came out when I was in high school called The Beautiful People by a questionable artist. But even that song built an entire category for the world, searching somewhere for a way of dividing the world and creating identities between those who were beautiful, those who kind of fit the model of what society wanted, and those who had rejected that model. And I think we live in a world that's desperate. Not just confused. I think we're far past that now. We're actually scrambling and desperate to find identity anywhere. And I think the roots of that is because we've abandoned the clear kind of what's laid out for us, the most simple and beautiful teaching imaginable that's laid out for us in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. So today, we find ourselves in the middle of kind of a three-week mini-series in this two-month longer series. And what we're actually going at, last week we asked the question, what is man? And working our way through Genesis 1 and the back and day 6 of Genesis 1, we wrestled with the question, what does it mean that God has been made in the image of God? What does it mean that he's been given a dominion or authority to exercise in the midst of the world? He's been given a vocation to be fruitful, to multiply, to fill the earth. That is foundational to this is what a man is. This is what a woman is. That we are made in these complementary genders, bearing the image of God. And so if you remember last week, we talked about the fact that the language of Genesis 1 is shot through with the construction of a temple during the times that Moses would have been written this. And if you went out to build a temple, if you remember this, because if you ever need to build a temple, it's vital that you do this correctly. You would build the temple and you would construct at the center of the temple an image of the God that was to be worshipped in that temple. And the job of the image was to reflect the glory, the goodness, the authority, the word, the power of who that deity was, who that God was. That Genesis 1 was constructed to kind of lay out for us this image of that the God had constructed a temple called the world, called the universe. That he filled it with life. He filled it with trees and fruit and grains. He filled it with animals. He filled it with birds. And he marked it with time and stars and sun and a moon. And in the midst of that temple, he placed an image. That image was put there to reflect in the midst of that temple, in the midst of this beautiful place that God has made, the character and the nature of God. And so we address the question, what is man? Over the next 2 weeks, I want to turn a bit, and given the fact that we are made in the image of God, what does that mean for what we're supposed to do? If Jack were here today and Jack were struggling with the question of what on earth, man, I've just spent all of this money in college, I've gotten to the end, and I don't know what I'm for. That's the question we want to drive at as we think our way through the end of chapter 1 and throughout chapter 2. If last week was about what is a man, this week is a how is a man, if you'll excuse the grammar. How do we do the things that God's called us to? And so the next 2 weeks, we're going to focus on that fundamental question. This week, we're going to take two basic ideas that are there in chapter 1 and in chapter 2, expand on them for a bit, and then we'll be done. We'll come back next week, and we'll spend all of our time in the back half of chapter 2. I want to read for us again, get this text in front of us from Genesis chapter 1, starting in verse 26. If you have a Bible, please open it there. If you don't have a Bible, please grab the one in the pew back in front of you. I want our eyes on the text as we talk about it. So starting in verse 26 and reading through the first three verses of chapter 2. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had made, that he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. This is the word of the Lord. So two observations. First, I am a creature. Does it feel obvious to you? Does it feel like a no-brainer to you? Thinking they're saying, we pay this guy to come up with these massive observations. You were made. Unless you kind of blow past that, I just want to establish that there may be no more controversial or maybe insulting thing that a human being can say to us in this particular day and age. You are created. Now, there are implications that flow from this about how you live your life in the world. And so I want to explore just a handful of those as we think about the fact that you were made. A few years ago, at a previous employer, we used to have a Christmas party every year. And at this Christmas party, we had to hand make an object to give to people at a white elephant gift thing, although they were like pretty legit gifts. So, sweet gift exchange. And so, you had to make something. And so, I decided I wanted to take up woodworking, which clearly has taken off in my life. I'm not very good at woodworking, but and so I had seen at Anthropology, I think, this wooden acoustic iPhone speaker, which was sweet. And I thought, I can totally make that. And it will look just as sweet. So I went out to the garage. I found a scrap piece of wood. And so began cutting and putting the whole thing together. And it was very elaborate. It was awesome. You had to Dremel, whatever. You had to cut a little channel in the wood. And you had to create a slot for the iPhone. I even put a little insert for the cord so you could charge your iPhone while it played music in this sweet acoustic iPhone speaker. And it had a little thing. And it looked awesome. And so then I glued it all together and kind of did all the things that you do with wood that you can tell me about later that I did. And so then I wrapped the gift, and I knew exactly what it was, right? Like, because I had made it, and I had the whole, and to me it was perfectly clear what it was for and what you were supposed to do with it. And so came the time for the great Christmas party, and I was so excited because I knew my gift was going to be the best gift of all the gifts, because who else is going to make a sweet acoustic iPhone speaker like me? Let me tell you, no one did like me. So we show up, people are opening their gifts, and all kinds of gifts are being given away, frames and stuff. So then someone opens my gift. Imagine my excitement as my gift that I'd spent roughly 4 hours on is being opened by this guy that I really know he's going to love it. Like, it's like the perfect guy to get this gift. So he opened the gift, and he looks at it. I'm so excited for him to just burst out in excitement, maybe even tears, who knows. A handmade acoustic speaker from my friend Brian. And he opens it, he looks at it, kind of flips it upside down. She wanted it, so I'm just going to say that she wanted the gift and I didn't give it to her. Flips it around, starts looking at it. Bangs on it, and then he smiles, and he's saying, oh, thank you so much, and it was kind of like a movie, this is so moving, and then he looks at me, and he says, what is it? To which I explained, a little shocked that he didn't know immediately, like, this is an iPhone speaker, and he said, what? Like, so stunned that it was an iPhone speaker that he could hardly imagine. He had no idea looking at it. And even if I told him what it was, he had no idea what it was. Like, how is this an iPhone speaker? Like, it just sits there. There's no wires. It's magical because it's acoustical. So I took out my phone and I put it in the little slot, even plugged it in so it could have some power, and showed him, played some music, and he could see how it was amplifying the music. Sort of, and it could sit beautifully on your desk, and he saw what it was for. And I tell that lengthy, kind of silly story to make the point that, like, if you're created, that means you have a creator. And you could be excused if you look around this room and you see humanity in all of our weirdness. Can we just admit that we're goofy? Like, we look goofy. Like noses. Have you ever thought about noses? And the different kinds of noses that there are. Or ears. And how it seems like on men they get bigger over time, don't they? Like, how strange we are, these human creatures. And so you'd be excused if you're sitting there and, like my friend who opened my acoustic speaker, amazing, very, if he was a little smarter, he would have known immediately what this was for. If you had a similar expression as you look around this room, because it's not you, obviously you're very clearly made to do things that you don't understand, but if you look around this room and thought, I mean, what on earth is a Justin for? Like, he wears poofy hoodies in the hottest rooms imaginable. He's like always cold. What is he for? We're like, I'm not going to pick on anybody else, just Justin, because he's easy to pick on. Like, but to acknowledge there's a creator means that there's an intention, there's a purpose. We've made reference several times in the last several weeks to just the story you believe lives at the foundation of the world. If you believe the evolutionary story, that we are simply the result, this world is simply the result of matter plus time plus chance. And if you add God to the story, it's matter plus time plus chance plus God tipping things occasionally. That has ramifications for what you think we're doing in this room. If you believe that God spoke, that he spoke into existence all that is, that has massive ramifications for what you think we're doing in this room. To believe there's a creator that has an intention, a purpose, an identity for what you're for. I would contend that can be either for you sitting in this room, the most constraining, binding thing imaginable, or it can be the most liberating thing you've ever imagined. Let's keep going with some things we can observe about the fact that we are a creature, that we have a creator. Two, all of these things are going to speak to the fact that we have constraints. You were made with a body. Like, you were an embodied person. And there's no way around that. We live in a world that is inundated with kind of the internet and constantly surrounding us with screens. I had a conversation with somebody last week who asked the question, hey, why don't we have screens on Sundays? And I'm not adamantly opposed to screens on some some theological standpoint. It's just that I believe we live in a world where we are constantly shown a reality that's false. On a phone, on a TV screen, on an iPad, we're constantly inundated with images, a reality that's malleable, that we can be in a video game, whoever you want to be, if you're good at video games, I'm not. You can watch a movie and enter into any story that's not actually unfolding in front of you that you want, that you're inundated with images that aren't actually embodied, they're not actually around you, they're just electrons, whatever they are, firing on a thing that shoots light at you. They're not real. And so here, why don't we have screens? Well, simple right now is like, we don't have a projector, but also like, we want one space to be absolutely embodied. That you're looking at a piece of paper that has ink on it. Like physical things that you can touch. That you're surrounded and constantly aware of, not losing yourself in an image in front of you, but constantly aware of the fact that there's someone next to you with shoulders that you could bump up against, and they have a voice, and it's sometimes good, and that there's physicality around you. No one in here can fly. You have limits. You're embodied. God's constrained your life. Some of you are really strong, and some of you are not strong. Some of you can run really far. I can't. I hate the idea of just thinking about running. It stresses me out. So, like we live embodied in the world, and those constraints are either for you a cause for bitterness. Like, I'm really mad every day I can't fly. I'm really mad every day that I don't look like this other person. I'm really mad that I'm not as beautiful as they are, or as thin as they are, or as strong as they are, or as athletic as he is. That can either be these limiting, frustrating constraints, or they can be beautiful and wonderful gifts to be received. Think of it like this. If I was given responsibility to mow my backyard, and there's no fence, it's just endless yard. There's no limits, there's no bounds, there's no definitions of what on earth I'm actually responsible for caring for using, for doing. There's just endless grass, constrainless life. On one level, that could be amazing. I don't have this little tiny backyard, and my dog can go to the far end of it to use the bathroom, and I don't have to clean up the poop that's so close to my house. On another level, it's like, what am I responsible for? Whose grass do I care for? So the physicality of life is something to be received from God and to be whatever it is to me, to be human, whatever it means to live out the vocation that God has instilled in us as human beings, it is embodied. It is within the constraints of the body that God has given you. Connected to that, made explicit in verse 27, that you were made male and female. Culture will tell you that these are accidents. They're unimportant. They're irrelevant to your identity as a person. In fact, that maleness or femaleness are not things that are given to us. They're things that are claimed or discovered or redirected by us on our own. Can I just say that that's not the vision of maleness and femaleness that the Bible gives us? But one of the most controversial things in the Bible, and it is stunningly beautiful, but it is called ugly in our culture, is that God has made men and women fundamentally different. Ontologically equal. Please don't misunderstand me. We're not saying that men are better or women are better. Absolutely filled with glorious value by God, bearing God's image in the world, but fundamentally different in ways that uniquely express that the manifold glories and beauty of God. And one of the curses of our day, and I would say of the last several days, like decades, is that we've never been able to live in the tension of saying men and women are different, created differently, made to express the beauty and the majesty and the power and the authority of God in completely different ways. And neither one is superior. And so we have in the past this kind of feminism that arose that said that women have to be more like men. And so we need to manifest the strength, the vitality, the kinds of characteristics that are common to men, because that's to be valued above all other values. In our day and age, it's switched. Men are not good. Men are abusive. Men are evil. Men are wicked. Men's strength is actually toxic. What would it be like to live in a community settled into the beautiful, glorious reality, the complexity of the fact that God has made us male and female? What would it be like to receive, men, your maleness, and to press fully into what does it mean to live as a man, bearing the image of God faithfully in the midst of the world? Women, what would it look like to receive your femininity as a gift? Not as something silly or something to be cursed, but as a gift. And that the best sort of life that you've been called to is not to kind of limit that or to marginalize that, but to live fully into, what does it mean for me to, this is getting tricky, what does it mean for me to live fully into my image-bearingness as a woman and not as a man, and as a man and not as a woman? And for us to do that together, you are a creature made male or female. Not here to discover which one you find inside of yourself. Not here to marginalize those realities. And for you, that can either be an embittering constraint, or it can be absolutely liberating. It's something you received as a gift from your creator, your maker, your shaper, who knows what you're here for. We're going to dive headlong into that next week as we get into the specific story of Adam and Eve. One more implication of that, that you were not made as, God is not, but whatever else he's up to in the universe, it seems that aloneness is not good. We're going to see that in chapter 2 specifically as God says it's not good that Adam would be alone. But even right here in chapter 1, intrinsic to the nature of what does it mean for us to bear the image of God, to exercise this kind of dominion and authority in the world, is that we're supposed to do it with other people. Like, we're not called to do that by ourselves. Whether that's in families or in tribes or in church communities or in neighborhoods, that there is a way of living out our the implications of our life together, bearing God's image in the world, that has to be done in the context of other people, which is horrific news for me as an introvert. Like, I can't live into faithfully all that God has called me to be by myself in my study, with my door closed, just with my books. I mean, it sounds amazing. Like 30 years, books, no people. Pastors aren't supposed to say that. I did. But whatever this world is, it requires a rubbing up against one another. It requires an eating together, a communication with one another, a taking on one another's burdens and living out this life with other people. Again, you can see this as a terrible constraint or as a gift to be received from a God who is gracious, who is kind, who's merciful, and has designed the world to be received. And then last, and kind of most foundational, you are not self-defined. You are not whatever you choose to be. The meaning of your life is not whatever you decide to make of it. The meaning of your sexuality is not whatever you desire. The meaning of your work is not whatever I decided to do, whatever I valued. All of these things, because we are creatures, are gifts. Again, constraints to be kicked against, or gifts to be received with gladness from God who is good, who is kind. If you're here today and you don't really know what to do with Christianity, I believe we live in a world that is desperate for identity, scrambling to attach it to anything we can, picking some of the most arbitrary things imaginable, whether that's sexual desire or the pigment of our skin or what part of the country you live in or your educational level or how much money you have or what clothes you like to wear or what kind of meat you like to wear. Do you like organic meat, farm-raised, free-range? Which kind of person are you? Picking political allegiances, which is a really strange thing to pick. Whatever the thing is, rooting our identity there. And I don't think it's working. I think it's simply creating mass confusion. We're taking good things, gifts from God, and attaching ourselves to them and seeking to find there an alleviation for our shame, an alleviation for our guilt, grace that will save us. It jumped out at me this week, just looking at like these feeds around the Enneagram, listening to a podcast with Brené Brown on it. We are desperate to find salvation. And we don't know where else to look but at ourselves. And then God, in his kindness, in his mercy, comes and says, quit trying to build your own identity. Quit trying to like reconstruct or discover deep inside your gut and who you really are and where you're really going to find salvation and where you're really going to find the alleviation of shame and live free. No, receive it as a gift, freely given, declared to you. And there will be parts of it you don't like. There will be parts of you that rub you the wrong way, but parts of it that don't feel satisfying. But what? Those are the options. Either construct your own life and find yourself honestly desperate and lost, or come to this God and receive from him the gift, the glorious, beautiful gift of an identity given to you by a God who spoke into existence everything it is. First, I am a creature. Second, I am an image bearer. So how does this relate to how we live our lives? Last week we talked about the temple. We talked about the image in the middle of the temple. And that was a nice image. It was a great background. But what is that actually, what are the implications of that for how we actually live our lives? Here's a question. Let's say I'm a painter. And I'm going to paint for you an image. An image of Justin in his poofy jacket. Sweating because he's, shivering because he's so cold. So I were to put this giant, what do painters paint on? Canvas, here in front of you, let's post it, and I were to paint for you a picture of Justin. Here's one way to get at this question. What would qualify this as a good image, and what would qualify this as a bad image? In other words, what would be the difference? I guarantee if I did it, it would be a bad image. the poofy jacket would be bright yellow, and that'd be the only way you know who he was. Like, what does an image do? What's an image for? It reflects the thing it's supposed to be imaging, right? Like, if this is a good painting, the definition of a good painting is you'd be able to look at it. Even if it was an abstract painting, it would tell you something. It would communicate to you something about the nature, the character of Justin. If it was just like a stick drawing with a head, that wouldn't tell you anything other than there was a stick drawing with a head. You wouldn't be able to know anything about the contours of Justin. You might know he has two arms and two legs. If it was a detailed picture with the circle with the pointy fingers, you would know maybe he had five fingers. But the better the image, the more full the image, the more clearly it would communicate the character, the nature, who Justin is. At one level, just what he looks like, but then dive even deeper into it. A gifted artist can communicate so much more than just the appearance of Justin. A really gifted artist, if he's painting a picture of Justin, could demonstrate through the painting his character. He could demonstrate what Justin likes. He could demonstrate the idiosyncrasies, not all of them, you're a far too complex person, but all the idiosyncrasies of his personality, of his character, of his goodness, of the things that he loves and the things that he hates. What is an image for? An image exists to communicate the nature, the character of the thing being imaged. So to say, to confess, I am an image bearer. It is not just to say something that about the intrinsic nature of what it means to be human. It is to say something about my vocation, what I'm for, what I'm supposed to do. As we begin next week to talk about particularly the context of work and family, however I live my life, in the particular ways I give expression to those two jobs that God has given humanity, I am to do so as one who reflects who God is and what God is like. Now, mirrors are image bearers, right? And you can have different kinds of mirrors. I was in the bathroom the other day that had, it was a shorter, squattier mirror, and so it made you look fatter. I didn't like that mirror. It's a bad image bearer. I really like the mirrors that are long and skinny, and they make you look like you weigh about 10 pounds less. And even if they have you seen those? They're skinny mirrors. Not like in a circus, but like just slightly skinny, like realistic skinny. Those are awesome. And I think that reflects a bit of what we try to do with the image of God that we see in the scriptures, right? I don't like the chubby version of that's sacrilegious. I was gonna say I don't like the chubby version of God. I don't like the picture of God I find in Romans chapter 9. And so I don't like the vision of God or the mandate or the way that he shapes marriage that I see in places like Genesis 2, come back next week, or Ephesians 5. I want a skinnier mirror or a squattier mirror. I want to alter what the Bible says about the nature and the character of God. And so I'm going to paint a different picture. I'm going to alter the image that's actually there. One of the things that we're to do as image bearers is bear the actual image of God, to reflect obedience to the God who's actually there, not the God that we wish was there, and not the God that we would like to be there, not the God that we would paint if we were painting a picture, but rather to go to the scriptures and discover and see and then reflect in the world through obedience, through trust, through delight, the God who's actually spoken to us in the scriptures. Which means you have to be a people. We have to be a people who know the Bible, who love the Bible, who wrestle with the Bible, who are desperate to understand what the Bible says and is and reveals about God. And lastly, we have to be a people, if we're going to faithfully paint a picture of who God is, who have to come again and again and again to the most stunning and glorious picture that God has given us of himself, namely in coming in the person of Jesus. Jesus, whose body was broken and blood was poured out. To bear the image of God means to reflect into the world the God who has revealed himself in Jesus Christ. The God who's come and lived the life we could not live. The God who spoke fiercely and harshly and devastatingly, and at the same moment would speak with the most grace and mercy and gentleness and kindness imaginable. The God who would heal the sick and at the next moment condemn the religious. The God who would speak terrifying words of judgment and magnanimous, glorious words of grace. To reflect into the world the image of a God whose body was broken for the redemption of his people and whose blood was spilled out for the forgiveness of our sins. This, Jack, or all of us, this is what you're here for. This is how we bear God's image in the world. This is how we exercise this dominion, this authority that he's given us. This is the flavor of whatever fruitfulness or multiplication or life that we begin to look at next week with more specificity. Whatever tone it's to take this tone. Bearing the image of God revealed to us in Jesus. God who spoke what is true. God who loved fiercely. God who bore our sins in our place. Let's pray.